With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom and donate today. Simply go to tntradio.live. From the Cold War to propaganda and the deep state, Pella Neuroth Taylor on today's News Talk, TNT.
Welcome to the Pella Neuroth Taylor Show on this Thursday afternoon from 3 to 5 p.m. UK time every weekday and, 3 to 5 p.m. European time every weekday and 2 to 4 p.m. UK time every weekday. So we've got a packed schedule today with Jeremy Hammond on first to talk about propaganda. We're brothers in arms on that topic. Will Hild next, talking about corporate wokeness to cover offshoring activities of UK corporations. After the break, we've got Per Carlson talking to us about Trump as Watergate Mark II and what really happened back then in 1972 and 73, that fabled incident which was made into film All the President's Men. Not everything is what you think, but we've become used to that, haven't we, that history is not what we think it is. Finally, we've got Kat Canada, who, as her name suggests, is going to talk to us about Canadian events and what's going on in America's northern neighbor and that former Dominion of Britain's, a country that of 40 million people that is not nearly enough often covered here. Anyway, we've got Easter coming up. Tomorrow's Good Friday, and there's a long Easter weekend, but the news here never lets up, so this show will be going on. But we'll talk a little bit about London. There's a British Museum exhibition in the Roman Empire, and it'll be focusing on Roman legionnaires, and it'll be packed. And I expect, from previous memories of outings, usually around Easter, to the British Museum, there'll be daffodils out. There will be a spring feeling. It'll be a massively popular exhibition with queues everywhere. People will be going and basking in the pubs afterwards in wonderful Bloomsbury, thinking about what they've just seen. Well, this is a story that you probably won't hear, but I thought I'd talk about it because people's minds are going to be far from politics, but politics never sleeps. So consider this. Are we in the equivalent of late stage Roman Empire? Now, I beg you to consider this. There's a paper in Science magazine, which is not so recently published, but sort of relatively recent in the science world. Time doesn't matter so much. A collaboration between the La Sapienza University in Italy, Oxford University, and Stanford. So very prestigious places. The lead investigator of this was a guy called Pritchard, and they were looking at the ethnicity of the late Roman Empire and the city of Rome. And they found out that it was something that people hadn't often looked at before, surprisingly enough, but they found out that it was very Middle Eastern and very Arabic and very few indigenous population. Now, being in Science magazine, which is America's premier science journal, it didn't go in too much into the consequences of this. But consider these things. They talk about a massive shift in Roman residence and in ancestry. The researchers found that the ancestry came primarily from the Eastern Mediterranean and Near East. That's Middle East to you and me. And the average Roman started to look very different. Well, all this had an impact on the fate of the Roman Empire, I think. Why did Rome change so much? Well, the ruling classes of Rome loved slaves to feed and wash and run their estates. It was a pull factor. But of course, later the slaves were liberated and took on jobs in the Roman administration. Then you had people going to Rome attracted to its possibilities as the hub of the modern world. And of course, that brought in the brightest and best from around the world. And in the later days of empire, the heads of the emperors were very seldom Italian or Roman. They came from the outer reaches of the empire. Rome suffered, one of the reasons for the change in demographics was a fertility crisis on top of the immigration. More and more people lived a life of luxury and became free and did not want to have the trouble of raising children. Women became enfranchised and preferred to do other things than having babies. So native Romans stopped having babies. So there were many causes for the fall of the Roman Empire, and it's the staple of every GCSE paper. The debasing of the currency is one issue, But basically, Rome had its own great replacement. And guess what countries are having their own great replacements? Well, it's us. We also saw a lack of a fallen patriotism as people lost faith in what Rome was about, and fewer people wanted to serve in the army. Roman farmers went to the cities and found out there was nothing to fight for, as they didn't recognize their country, as the old slaves increasingly began to control city administrations and shifted the religion from the old gods to the new religion, which came from the Middle East, Christianity. And then even the capital moved from Rome to the city of Byzantium, which is today's Istanbul. So I ask you to draw your own conclusions about that. But it's interesting. I just want to quote Aristotle in his Politics Book 5, section 1314a, because they're different translations, but they have that same reference. And there he talks about how tyrants and emperors prefer foreigners because it's easy to rule them. If you mix up your populations, the population will be less united against your imperial designs. And you won't get together because you don't feel a sense of unity with the other people of your city, and you won't topple bad leadership. So maybe we are heading to late Roman Empire in our era, and we'll wonder if the Chinese, whoever lives in 2,000 years' time, will have their own museum where they investigate the history of the American and European Empire and what they will have to represent us. Will it be old copies of Britney Spears CVDs? Will it be, I don't know, iPhones or what? Anyway, away from that historical backgrounder, we will be talking to you about the day's latest news from our brilliant political editor Basil Valentine after a quick break. This is Pelle Neroth Taylor on TNT New Talk.
Keeping the commitment 24/7.
I've been in the car all day and I got to listen.
Can't get enough of it.
You guys are doing a great job.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
We're supposed to have Basil on, I think.
I'm on. I'm here, Pelle.
Oh, hi, Basil. Sorry, I missed you on the screen there.
Not at all.
Hi, how are you? So what hot news have you got for us today?
Well, unfortunately, the rhetoric with Vladimir Putin continues to be ramped up. On the one hand, he has said he has no intention of attacking any NATO countries, and that was widely reported. But needless to say, the press in Western Europe and North America are interpreting his remarks a very different way, claiming he's ramping up his threats to NATO, vowing that Russia will disintegrate any advanced aircraft sent to Ukraine. The United States in August, of course, gave its allies permission to hand over the F-16 jets to Kiev. And Ukraine's foreign minister, Dmytro Kuleba, has announced that the aircraft are expected to arrive in his country soon. Putin was speaking during a visit to Torzok, to the 344th Army Aviation Center. But when you see numbers like that, Pelle, I always wonder if that means there are at least 343 other army aviation centers. But anyway.
I doubt it. I think these numbers kind of randomly picked, you know. But you could be right. it could be kind of anyway, PSYOPs thing, you know.
Well, exactly. 344th is army aviation centers. A lot of army aviation centers, isn't it? Anyway, yeah. He was questioned as to whether he would consider the F-16 sent by NATO members as a viable target, to which he replied, "Of course, if they are used from airfields of third countries, they become a legitimate target for us, no matter where they are. We will destroy their planes in the same way that we destroy their tanks, armored vehicles and other equipment, including multiple launch rocket systems." The Russian leader added, "The F-16s are also carriers of nuclear weapons, and we will have to take this into account when organizing combat work." However, Putin claimed the deployment of F-16s will not help Ukraine overturn the situation on the battlefield.
Well, I don't know how. I didn't read the Russian original about that, because it all hinges on what the word "they" refers to. I mean, will they target does the "they" bit refer to bases on Polish and Romanian soil? Or does it refer to the planes themselves? And maybe that strategic ambiguity was very deliberately phrased as such by Putin, because if Russia attacks them in Polish bases as before they take off, which would obviously make them an easy target, it's going to be an Article 5 issue for NATO, which means NATO will join the war If, on the other hand, right. I mean, they're attacked in Ukrainian airspace, then it's not an issue, you know. So, you know, it's very dangerous stuff, because the F-16s are not that formidable, I don't think. I mean, they're like, what is it, 1970s vintage, and the latest Soviet-Russian aircraft are much more powerful. But, you know, it could be a dangerous thing if it's not that they're dangerous in the air. It's that they're a dangerous and tempting target on the ground. And, yes, you know, yeah, right. Well, so what's your take? I mean, have you followed this story quite closely?
Well, it was only a couple of days ago that Wojciech Kosiniak-Kamysz, the Polish military chief, said that NATO came within inches of all-out war with Russia when Poland reported a violation of its airspace by a Russian missile. This occurred near the town of Osadel in the Lublin Voivodeship and has put the whole region on high alert. The Ministry of National Defense confirmed that missile monitoring is conducted jointly with Ukrainian authorities, underscoring the collaborative efforts to safeguard against potential threats. During the intrusion, Kosiniak-Kamysz assured the public that stringent measures are in place to ensure safety, etc., etc. If there was any indication that the Russian missile was heading towards a target in Poland, it would be shot down, he said. The gravity of the situation was underscored by the swift response from Polish authorities, with the Deputy Prime Minister saying, "All actions have been taken to inform the most important people in the country. We are in contact with the operational command of the armed forces." You know, it's all getting very, very dangerous and very, very testy, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's there's a lot of shadow boxing as well. I mean, the Russians have gone a bit quiet on the ISIS Ukraine British link of the attack, and I'm going to talk about it in my next monologue about how the Russian media, alternative media, and Russian parliamentarians are talking about how it's suspiciously could be a Russian false flag against their own people, in the sense that there's no security on and they didn't turn up. So, you know, just as 9/11, suspicious absence of the U.S. Air Force and you know, and it all, but at the same time, that shows you that the Russian media is much more open than we think, because they talk about the same things that we talk about, which is we talk about false flags going on in our own countries. Well, parliamentarians in the Parliamentarian Gazette, or whatever it's called, openly airing the possibility that the Russians were attacking themselves to give them an excuse to escalate in Ukraine. Anyway, yes, they've gone quiet about linking it to Britain, but I don't know. I mean, it could be the British.
George Galloway linked it to Britain in his monologue on the mother of all talk shows last night, and has been roundly condemned by British politicians. On the other hand, you know, with respect to Putin seeking some gain out of it, other commentators are saying no, it's a massive own goal for Putin. Roger Boys, writing in the Times, says that Putin's political survival has been based on him being more protective of the motherland than the last Soviet leader, Mikhail Gorbachev, saying that Russian towns have by and large been sheltered from the nastiness, and that Putin is seen as the great protector, but that the attack on the Crocus City Hall has exposed the shakiness of that claim. Putin's claim to be Russia's sword and shield, with the unpreparedness of the security apparatus for a new threat and low credibility of the regime's war rhetoric. He added that the sequence of events charts how Putin is losing control of the narrative. And that's what it's all about these days, Pelle, isn't it? It's all about control of the narrative.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the British, because they have aircraft carriers that don't actually work and things like that. I mean, they've invested so much in regime change using human assets. And I've always thought about that. I mean, how much is a Challenger tank? I checked this morning, it's £4 million. And that goes up in smoke as soon as it goes to Ukraine. Well, with £4 million, you can buy 100,000 journalists or 1,000 Tajiki activists, you know, and they'll put that money to good use all over the former Soviet Union. So when I'm saying that it was a Russian self-imposed false flag, it could actually be, you know, a really bad, that the British have control of the whole Crocus security situation, you know, I don't know. But anyway, yeah, well, maybe there's some point there that Putin is losing the narrative, and he has to either back down or go with the hawks like Patrushev, you know, who's chairman or the FSB chief. So, I mean,
or we think even that, worse, the billionaire Konstantin Malofeev, Putin's billionaire pal, who has called for a nuclear strike on Ukraine after the Crocus Hall fiasco. Well, so, I mean Putin is a moderate by comparison.
We think it's a monolithic opinion scene. It's not at all. I mean, I said people vigorously describe, criticize the war, usually from the right, I have to say. And Dmitry Trenin, who was this mild-mannered professor who used to be at the Carnegie Institute and quite pro-Western and with the West, you know, he's now saying, yeah, Russia's got to conduct nuclear tests and then have a no-fly zone of the Black Sea, which, of course, means taking out all those drones that are floating around or flying around outside territorial water. So, in other words, send a signal to the West. And, of course, so Putin will be under pressure to do something about those F-16s if they do come. And so I do worry, you know, might book a holiday
indeed under pressure to retaliate against somebody for the Crocus Hall massacre. $2.2 trillion spent on weapons of war last year, a record for humanity, a most unwanted one, Pelle.
Anyway, Basil, thanks for that update on what's going on in Russia. We'll talk more about it in the next hour in my next monologue. But talk to you soon, Basil. We're going to break now. This is Pelle Neroth-Taylor Show on today's News Talk TNT.
TNT's David Curtin.
In my mind, government spending in the UK is absolutely horrendous. It has got completely out of control over the last 14 years of Conservative rule and 13 years before that of Labour rule. You would probably be astounded if you actually knew how much the government spent. In this financial year, these are the figures, the estimate for how much it wants to spend on everything or how much it needs to spend is £1.2 trillion or $1.2 million, if you like, which is an amount of money that we cannot really comprehend.
David Curtin on today's News Talk, TNT.
I was such a young age. Everything changed. My name is Chloe. When I was 13, my dad was diagnosed with cancer. When I found out, I just didn't know how to react. I felt like everything was just kind of closing in on me. It just became a routine. Dad's doing chemo. I'd come home from school, wait for mum to finish work, and we'd go straight to the hospital, spend a few hours there, just draw. It was hard to navigate going to school. Hundreds of kids, and I was the only one with a dying dad. He was diagnosed in March, and then he died in October. Towards the end, I heard about Canteen. It kind of felt nice to know that they had other people like me. They understood what I was going through, and we didn't even have to chat about cancer. In 2020, I became a youth ambassador, so I can help others the way they helped me. I've done so many things since I was 13. I've graduated high school, university, gotten my license, made a move across the country. Life now is just a whole lot more fun. Please give a gift today to support more young people like me experiencing cancer.
Today's News Talk.
News and information.
TNT Radio.
Welcome back to the Pelle Neroth-Taylor Show on TNT News Talk. We've got our brilliant first guest today, Jeremy R. Hammond, who's an independent journalist and author who exposes dangerous propaganda serving to manufacture consent for criminal government policies, something I agree with, particularly related to US foreign policies and economic freedom and health freedom. His books include Obstacle to Peace, the US Role in the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict, The War on Informed Consent, The Persecution of Dr. Paul Thomas by the Oregon Medical Board, and the New York Times versus Robert Kennedy Jr., How the Mainstream Media Spread Vaccine Disinformation. And you can find him on jeremyrhammond.com and on Twitter. Welcome to the show, Jeremy.
Thanks for having me.
You talked a little, to us a little bit about the conflict in Gaza, because that's not my expertise, but I did read a summary of your talk you gave, and your book is highly recommended by commentators I admire, like Noam Chomsky, Scott Horton, Max Blumenthal, and Philip Giraldi. So you know, those are good things to have under your belt. Didn't read the whole book. But I thought that the thing is about these issues is that you don't want name calling. That doesn't lead to elucidation. But often most of us don't have time to read all these long books like the Benny Morris starting with 1948. I mean, life is short. Even for current affairs freak like myself, time is limited, you know, and I've read a lot of Ukraine, for instance, but not so much about Palestine. But what I thought that your talks did was they actually explain it enough so that you can have a conversation with the opposing side and place a couple of arguments that kind of enlighten us. So I thought we could talk a little bit about the origins of Israel, because you're kind of taking a, from a legalistic point of view, a sort of rather anti-Israel stance. But starting with, well, let's start with what happened in the 1940s, because I assume, I'm like the everyman on this topic, that the UN awarded Israel its existence in 1948, but it didn't actually do that, did it? So can you start, take us off on that argument?
No, this is one of the key foundational myths of the conflict, is that, you know, a lot of people believe that the UN created Israel. I used to believe that because we hear it constantly, and it's just kind of, we're indoctrinated into that belief. But I went back and just, you know, when I started getting into independent journalism and in U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, I started doing a deep dive into the Israel-Palestine conflict and just going back to the document, starting with reading UN Resolution 181, which is where this this idea comes from. The General Assembly passed Resolution 181 in November 1947, which recommended what, you know, the famous partition plan, or infamous partition plan, perhaps. But that plan was never implemented. This is what people don't understand. So first of all, the General Assembly has no authority to, had no authority to partition Palestine. The General Assembly, its resolutions are not legally binding on member states. Security Council resolutions are legally binding. So this was a General Assembly resolution, and it was, the partition plan was come up, it was come up with by the UN Special Committee on Palestine, or UNSCOP. And there was actually a majority and a minority recommendation under the UNSCOP committee. And the majority recommendation was to partition Palestine. The minority actually objected to this plan because they correctly pointed out that it was actually contrary to the UN Charter, because the UN Charter, of course, recognizes the right to self-determination as a universal right of all peoples. And they pointed out that the partition plan was prejudicial to the Palestinians, and was premised on a rejection of their self-determination, which was readily admitted right in the UNSCOP report, where they said, they acknowledged right in there that the principle of self-determination was, quote, not applied to Palestine, and it, for the reason to, being to support the Zionist project and the Zionist goal to reconstitute Palestine into a demographically Jewish state. And so the fundamental root cause of the conflict, in my assessment, is the rejection of Palestinians' right to self-determination. So the partition, the UN General Assembly in Resolution 181 recommended the partition plan, and recommended that the Security Council take up that question. It did go to the Security Council, and that's where it died, because as the UN representative at the time pointed out, the Security Council had no authority to partition Palestine against the will of the majority of its inhabitants. And so the plan died. And so there's this ongoing myth that the resolution partitioned Palestine. It neither legally partitioned Palestine nor conferred, this is very important, nor conferred any legal authority to the Zionist leadership for their unilateral declaration of the existence of the State of Israel on May 14th, 1948. Another myth is that when that so-called Declaration of Independence, as Israelis call it, when on May 14th, when they declared the State of Israel, that the neighboring Arab states invaded Israel to wipe it off the map. This is another very deceitful narrative. Because, of course, Israel did not exist as a legally defined entity. It had no legally recognized borders. Most of the land in Palestine, Jews at the time owned only about 7% of the land in Palestine. Arabs owned more land in every single district and, of course, were the majority. The whole purpose of the mandate under the British and the League of Nations, the whole purpose of the British occupation of Palestine was to deny the Palestinians their right to self-determination. for the purpose of facilitating the Zionist project, to the settler colonial project, to reconstitute Palestine into a Jewish state. And by the time the Zionist leadership's unilateral declaration, over a quarter million Arabs had already been ethnically cleansed from their homes. And so the neighboring Arab states intervened into Palestine to try to stop the ethnic cleansing, although they had they mostly failed to do that.
Yeah.
And the end result was 750,000 refugees.
Interrupt you there, because we're going to go into a news break, but I just summarize what you said. It's really interesting. So often in history, who is the aggressor and who is the defensive guy? I mean, you know, both the Russians and the West and the Ukrainians say they're on the defensive. And it depends on where you chop off history, where you take history as your starting point. It's like a bar fight. Who strikes the first blow? Well, if you edit the film, so you edit out the guy's first blow, then it'll seem that the guy's responding back is the aggressor. And that's exactly what it seems to be here. Well, what we'll do, we'll carry on this topic just after a quick news break. Very, very interesting and very easy to understand. Thank you very much, Jeremy. Into the news now. This is Pelin.
Really big. The biggest breaking news story. Big, gigantic, big, enormous.
TNT Radio News.
Matt Boyland here with a look at your TNT headlines. A hailstorm has wiped out a solar farm in Texas, highlighting the perils of swapping traditional power sources for vulnerable green alternatives. Police are investigating the motive behind a mass stabbing in the United States, and there's outrage in Australia after it was revealed a women's soccer team who dominated an all-women's tournament in Sydney, winning every game they played, only did so because they had five biological males on their side.
Globalist agendas, democratic rights at risk, corruption, propaganda. It never stops. For the news and views silenced by the mainstream media, by government and corporations, vote one. TNT Radio. Free speech always has a home here. Stay up to date with the latest live news and current affairs delivered by our lineup of expert commentators and hosts. Listen to TNT Radio anywhere you go. Ask Alexa or Google to play TNT Radio or download the TNT Radio app for free from the App Store or Google Play. Today's news talk. This is TNT Radio.
Welcome back to the Pelin Eroth Taylor Show. We've got Jeremy Hammond with us, an independent journalist who's written books on the Israel-Palestine conflict called The Obstacle to Peace and a lot of other stuff as well. And he explains in very easily understood terms some of the myths which have turned out to be not true and which we're kind of undoing here. Now, as I understand it, as a non-specialist, I mean, there was this Israeli claim to Palestine on sort of ethnic, genetic roots, if you like, or historical roots. But you're sort of taking an axe to that claim. Explain.
Well, sure. There's the claim that, you know, that the land of Palestine was rightfully belonged to the Jewish people based on the claim of historical ancestry in that region. And the idea, you know, the biblical argument that there was once a kingdom of Israel there and the kingdom of Judah. And so there's a couple of points to be made about that. Number one, looking at the ancestry, it's true that Jewish peoples have a strong ancestral connection to that land. DNA studies show that. With Ashkenazi Jews, however, in particular, there is also on the maternal side, when looking at DNA studies, on the paternal side, there remains that historical ancestral connection. But looking at the maternal side of things, what the studies indicate is there was a lot of conversion to Judaism. And so this is one of the problems where, you know, a European Jew with no ancestral connection to the land whatsoever can go to Israel and become a citizen and own property in Israel, whereas Palestinian refugees ethnically cleansed from their homes cannot return.
Interrupt, carry on the thought in a moment. But I mean, because thought that, I mean, Jews were not exactly popular in medieval Europe or historical Europe. What benefits, I mean, so what you're saying is European, you know, people of Slavic origin or Germanic origin converted. What were the benefits to doing that?
Through marriage, it seems that, you know, along paternal lines, again, that I think more the women would convert to their husband's religion, essentially, is what it appears to be. And again, this is, I'm not basing this on, you know, cultural studies or social studies or anything. I spent quite a bit of time researching DNA studies. So I'm just looking at like the question of DNA and genetic ancestry. Another issue is, there's two additional issues. One is that the Palestinians also have a very strong historical connection to the land. In fact, they are descended from Canaanites. And an interesting thing is that Israel, you know, there's this kind of biblical narrative of the Israelites being foreigners to Canaan, outsiders who came into the land and violently conquered it, including through acts of genocide. But the archaeological record, there's no evidence for that narrative in the record. And the DNA studies indicate that Israelites, too, are descended from Canaanites. So they were native to that land. They weren't foreign invaders.
Just to summarize, you're saying that, I mean, they're citing the Bible. Gosh, I mean, I haven't read the Bible since I was about 14, you know, but I mean, when we had religious studies class, but basically a sort of the claim of the Jews is the Israelites were Jewish, conquered, the land that is today Israel thousands of years ago. And that claim of conquest is what gives them the right to live there now. But that claim you just said is not true because the Bible, of course, the Bible is not history. It's myth, isn't it? So, but carry on your line of thought. I mean, we're going to get a lot of comments about this. You know?
Sure. Yeah. And there was a kingdom of Israel at one point. There's debate about how extensive that kingdom was. There are Israeli historians and archaeologists who actually argue that, you know, that it was kind of a very small little kingdom. And there's a dispute about whether, you know, this united kingdom of David and Solomon ever existed. But there certainly was a kingdom of Israel at one point in history, around the 12th century BC. But yeah, this idea that, you know, and going back to the point about the DNA origins and the genetic ancestry. So the closest related groups of people to Jewish groups are the Palestinians, the Druze, and the Bedouin. So Palestinians are actually very closely related to Jews. And they both are, their genetic ancestry is back to the Canaanite tribes. Palestinians are indigenous to Palestine,
right,
is the point. And so they also have a very strong historical ancient connection to the land. And so there's this kind of this denial that that's the case. And there are just myths about how the Arabs, one of the myths, in fact, there was a hoax book written about it called From Time Immemorial, is that the Arabs only immigrated into Palestine. You know, it was an empty land. And then the Jews came there and reclaimed the land. And only then the Arabs like mass migrated into Palestine, but this is all nonsense. So there's a lot of just historical nonsensical.
Yeah, I mean, I guess. To fast forward, because I mean, we could take an argument that where do you take the cutoff point for rights to land? Because, you know, as you well know, America's founded on genocide. So is Australia, where this channel is based, and so on. So anyway, I don't want to go into that argument right now. And even the South African whites say the Bantus. It's a Bantu settler state. The Bantus came from Congo and the whites came from Europe, and they neither has more right to it than the other. It's the Hottentots who should have the land, you know. Anyway, just to fast forward to 2005.
Well, no, could I comment on that real quick? Because that's the other point. I want to come to. I'll try to make it brief. But essentially, DNA is no basis for property rights. It's absurd. And, you know, property rights, individuals have rights. There's no such thing as like a group of people defined by race or ethnicity to certain property. So you have to be able to trace individual property rights. And so time itself is kind of a natural statute of limitations, because the further back in history you go, the harder it is to actually be able to trace a property claim of an individual, to their ancestors today. And so that's the other really important point to make, is that this whole idea that, you know, DNA or ethnicity or religion is a basis for property rights is absurd. And we need to look at individual property rights. And of course, that the right of the Arab peoples living in Palestine was absolutely prejudiced and violated under the British mandate and then under the Zionist conquest of Palestine.
Incredibly interesting. I wish we'd have you on for longer, but we just, I'm afraid we've just got 2 minutes left. And we've got just, we just talked about Hamas circa 2005. We've got Sheikh Ahmed Yassin announcing a shift in Hamas policy, saying that he'd be happy to accept a Palestinian state along the pre-67 lines. And yet Israel went ahead and assassinated him and then assassinated his successor. I mean, why did he do that if he was essentially going along with what Israel wanted?
Well, the threat of Hamas was the threat coming from Hamas was the idea that it was going to moderate and move away, like the PLO before it, move away from armed violence and armed conflict, armed resistance, to engagement in the political process and diplomacy, which is, of course, we saw that with the PLO. And in fact, when the PLO, the same year, 1988, when the PLO officially accepted the two-state solution, it had been accepting the two-state solution since the mid-70s, but in 1988, the PLO officially accepted it as a matter of policy, in a policy document. So that same year, the Hamas charter was published. And Israel initially actually supported Hamas as a counterforce to the PLO precisely because of the threat of peace coming from the PLO, where Arafat had gained recognition as a peace partner, as a legitimate leader of the Palestinian people. And the last thing Israel wanted was for Hamas to follow that path because, of course, Israel wants, essentially, the Zionists want all the land of Palestine, but without the Palestinians. And so the two-state solution is a threat to their goals, which is why, of course, we have the illegal settlement regime and the ongoing occupation of the Palestinian territories.
So Jeremy, we've got to wind up here. So just to summarize, Hamas was not extremist enough, and that's why they had to assassinate that leader.
Israeli policies have served to radicalize Hamas and keep it radicalized at the expense of the moderate leadership of the Palestinians, essentially.
Right. Jeremy Hammond, thank you very much. I'd love to have you on again. Really interesting. I mean, the point is that not that you're necessarily 100% right, but you give something that's refutable and arguable against next time, or maybe another guest. Really interesting and probably very true. Thank you very much, Jeremy Hammond. This is Pelin Eroff-Taylor's show on TNT News Talk, and we've got another guest coming up in just 2 minutes. Thanks, Jeremy.
The challenges our planet's animals are facing sometimes feel a bit heavy.
The animals haven't eaten in a day, 2 days, they haven't drank anything, they're cold, they're dehydrated.
As soon as we started our descent, everywhere I could see was mud, just absolutely mud.
The country has been in prolonged drought so long, it was like a tinderbox waiting to go up.
Okay, very heavy. Each of us wants to be part of the solution, and we can be. Remember that there's good happening right now. At home.
All right, we were able to get into your unit and we have all four of your cats. So,
okay.
And around the world. For any animal in any disaster. So let's focus on that, right? Be part of the solution, one rescue at a time. Search ifa.org/disaster ready.
The thing that drives me every day as a dad is him. Every day he's hungry for something. And there's this huge responsibility in making sure that he's a good person. I think the advice I would give is you don't need to know all the answers. It's okay to make mistakes. As long as it's coming from love, then it kind of starts to work itself out.
Coming to you live from Sweden, you're with Pelle Nyroth-Taylor on today's News Talk, TNT.
So welcome back to the Pelle Nyroth-Taylor show on TNT News Talk. So our next guest is going to talk about this topic related to Trump. People never tire of talking about Trump and the upcoming election, and we will go along with that. So one of the reasons for Trump's popularity, I think, is that he seems to stand up for the little guy in the small town America, who's maybe lost his job as manufacturing has moved away offshore to China or Asia. Meanwhile, the fat cat corporates exploit this while raking in federal subsidies at the same time as they spam the intellectual sphere of America with woke advertising that makes them seem more virtuous than they in fact are. So to talk about that is a guy who's actually researched this and tried to campaign against it. His name is William Hild, who's the executive director of Consumers Research. He's trained as a lawyer. He has a decade of nonprofit and legal and public policy experience. He served as a deputy director of the Regulatory Transparency Project. And before that, he worked at the Philanthropy Roundtable as a director of external affairs for the Culture of Freedom Initiative. Thanks for coming on the show, Will. How are you?
Good, and glad to be with you. Thanks for having me.
So you are campaigning against BlackRock and ESG, which you'll explain in a moment, but you came to our attention in your series of ads that sort of, which kind of made fun or highlighted as well, the sort of double standards of huge corporations like American Airlines and Coca-Cola and Nike and whatnot, who are sort of famous. What are they? They're deluging us with woke adverts at the same time as they're not such good guys, really. Can you tell us that story?
Certainly. Well, I think what you're referencing is our Consumers First initiative, which is our ongoing multi-million-dollar ad campaigns against companies that go woke in order to distract from the skeletons they have in their closet, their misdeeds in the market and how they produce their goods, like in the case of slave labor that they use in China, or their mistreatment of their customers, like American Airlines, rated one of the worst airlines in the country by Wall Street Journal 2 years in a row. They kicked the most people off of flights involuntarily. They shortened legroom during COVID when everyone else was just trying to keep the flights going. American Airlines took the opportunity to make flying worse for their customers. And so this was a phenomenon that we saw happening over and over again in the market, where companies, instead of focusing on their consumers, would cozy up to woke activists and woke politicians in order for hands out, special favors, favorable treatment in the press at the Washington Post and the New York Times, those types of mainstream left-wing publications. And so we decided we're just going to call that out. We're the nation's oldest consumer protection organization, and we were tired of seeing the consumer actually come last as the priority for these corporations. And so we said, listen, if these corporations and these CEOs in particular are going to start wading into politics and acting like politicians, then we're going to treat them that way. And so we started running multi-million dollar ad campaigns, naming and shaming these companies.
What was the feedback from that? Did you get a good response?
Yes. I mean, first of all, we had thousands of consumers from across the country reach out to us to thank us for that. Obviously, they leaned conservative, but we had people, independents and even liberals, reaching out and saying, thank you so much. Regardless of my politics, I'm tired of being preached at by these corporations that are supposed to be serving me. They're supposed to be worried about what I want and giving me that, not telling me what to think, how to vote, that kind of thing. And it kind of reached peak wokeness in 2021, right before we launched our campaigns. When you had some of these corporations, you named some of the first ones we hit, American Airlines, Nike, Coca-Cola, weighing in on election integrity legislation fights at individual states. So they were coming into states like Georgia and Texas and calling, you know, voter ID laws and such things Jim Crow, and that they were going to use every avenue they had as a big corporation in those states to push back. So you really had them weighing in the political process on an area that's not really, you know, what do they know about running an election? That's not really their business.
And so, I mean, wasn't that Georgia legislation actually to make, I mean, I don't know what you stand on the stolen election claims, but I mean, Georgia was one of those controversial states. And it seemed to be reading up on it quickly that legislation is aimed at making elections more transparent. I mean, who can object to that? You know, mail-in voting is banned in most countries because of fraud issues. But in the US, you know, you seem to let these things go on anyway. So what the hell does Coca-Cola have to do with that? You know, but as you said, it's to curry favors. We tend to think of capitalists operating. I mean, I'm pro-capitalist or pro-market forces, but I'm not, being pro-capitalist is not necessarily the same thing, because capitalism has sometimes been called communism for the rich. Well, it's corporate capitalism anyway. A lot of lobbying, a lot of favors and so on. So it's all right for the big companies to get socialist handouts, but not all right for the little guy to get socialist handouts. And that's what we often seem to talk about when the big firms talking about capitalism. They want favors, you know. And so even though they might be losing market share, I mean, there's one famous example that reached Europe, which was in Bud Light, which has had a kind of a blue collar consumer ship. And they went transgender, and you think that's insane. I mean, my father's in advertising. He said, "You don't insult your customers. That's like rule number one. The dollar is the bottom line. If they don't buy your goods, you'll go bankrupt. But if they can compensate for that by lobbying favors or handouts from government, to even compensate for those Bud Light losses, then it all makes sense. So what happened to that Bud Light thing? Yeah.
Certainly. Well, I think you're 100% right. William F. Buckley once said that the problem with socialism is socialism. The problem with capitalism is capitalists. And I think people would do well to remember there's a difference between a system of property rights and free competition in the market and glorifying and deifying the people who are running those businesses. They are as fallible as you or I. And in many cases, they succumb to the siren song of corruption and seeking government handouts and special favors. And it often does turn into capitalism for most of us, socialism for the very people at the top. That's one of the things that actually happened in the state of Georgia. They were getting Delta, one of the airlines that operates out of there that threatened the state over this election integrity legislation, actually almost lost a fuel subsidy that had been carved out for them. And I would support them losing it just on free market terms. I don't think the state should be handing out special favors, but they certainly shouldn't be handing out special favors to corporations that turn around and then try to hijack their very legitimate political process to simply make sure that their elections, you know, regardless of whether you think 2020 was outright stolen, or if you just think that mail-in ballots are not a very good idea, as you noted, the vast majority of the rest of the world does not allow mail-in ballots. I don't know of any European country that does. South America has mostly banned them. So this is not uncommon to call banning, you know, mail-in ballots Jim Crow is an insane statement. And yet that's the kind of rhetoric they were using against their own home state. So it just tells you how much they answer to, woke politicians and woke activists. And then maybe another area we could get into, woke asset managers like BlackRock and State Street and Vanguard that unfortunately control large portions of the free float of these shares of these companies.
I know less about that topic, where I have less strong opinions, but perhaps you can tell me, because I saw one of your articles that talked about BlackRock. So go ahead and attack BlackRock.
Certainly. So asset managers are companies that basically you give
them your money, either through ETFs, funds, or directly, and then they go buy shares on your behalf.
So if you've ever bought an S&P 500 index fund to invest broadly in the market, then you've used an asset manager. And while technically those shares belong to you, they've been purchased with your money, and when you go to sell them, they have to give them to you. While they're in the custody of these asset managers, they can use those shares to have a lot of influence at these major corporations. And so they end up, it's not that they own large portions of these companies, it's that they control large portions of these companies. And the largest, and I would say the worst, is BlackRock. It's a company that it's got about $9.5 trillion of assets under management. A lot of that is individual 401ks and brokerage accounts, but also large money of his state, local, and federal pension funds here in the United States, and sovereign wealth funds from across the world. So they are custodians and stewards of a lot of wealth from across the world, but they themselves get to walk into corporate boardrooms and make decisions about how those shares are used. And so they've actually, up until recently, when we started calling them out, were bragging about the number of ways in which they bully corporate C-suites and boards of directors to push harmful so-called net zero targets, to push companies to be more woke, to engage in like the election legislation fights that I described earlier, but also wading into this trans LGBTQ types of issues. Larry Fink is on record saying that now infamous quote that he gave during a national interview where he said at BlackRock, we believe that if behaviors are going to change, they're going to have to be forced to change. And at BlackRock, we are forcing behaviors to change. He was actually talking about race and sex-based quotas for the boards of directors that his company is quote unquote invested in. So this is these asset managers, and BlackRock in particular, have incredible amounts of power to push around corporate America. And that's what we've seen, is that they've become more afraid of these large asset managers than they are of their own customers, who they're supposed to be serving.
That's an incredibly interesting story. These powerful people investing your money, and you might not be on board with these views necessarily, and you don't know where the money's going, and these non-entities or these nothing guys spending your money or using your money to exercise enormous power, and they're kind of completely anonymous. I'd actually heard of BlackRock, but I mean, you stated it beautifully in a simple way, the exact issue. And presumably, I mean, I haven't seen much mainstream coverage of BlackRock. Is it because BlackRock bribes or in some way or another corrupts journalism or invests in journalism?
Yes, at the national press level, that is somewhat true. The major publications like Bloomberg and Financial Times and CNBC often they're reporters, not all of them, there are some good reporters there, but the vast majority of that of those publications are worried about losing access to BlackRock, to the other asset managers, because, you know, if they question what BlackRock's doing, you know, they're the biggest mover in the market, they're the biggest player. Losing access to that is a little bit like a political reporter losing access to the president or something like that. So they're usually loath to be critical of BlackRock and other asset managers and what they're doing. Now, that was actually, we mentioned the beginning of our advertising campaigns against American Airlines and Nike and Coca-Cola. We had a number of companies, but eventually we got around in October of 21 to launching our BlackRock campaign. And we've been running ads against BlackRock, consumer education ads, helping people understand how important BlackRock is. It's a company they've probably never heard of. It was not a household name when we started, but they're probably the most important company in the world you'd never heard of, or at least you'd never heard of at the time we launched our campaigns. Now, a lot has changed in the last 2 to 3 years since we've launched our campaigns. At the state level in the United States, there is a ton of traction, especially in conservative Republican-held states, to push back. Just a few days ago, actually, we saw the Mississippi Secretary of State take an administrative action against them that could lead to them being banned from doing business in the state of Mississippi for fraudulent use of people's assets. We've seen a number of state treasurers divest billions of dollars. Again, just 2 weeks ago, the Texas Permanent School Fund, so piggy bank for the Texas school system, divested $8.5 billion from BlackRock. So you're starting to see a lot of state elected officials look at what's going on and say, really, we don't want our money used to be attacking our own values. And so BlackRock is losing power. So I always want to stress in interviews when I talk about these things, I talk about these big asset managers and all the money they have and all the power they have. I don't want to give people a fatalistic impression or a nihilism. There's absolutely good things happening. We just have to keep the pressure on.
Well, my next question was going to be, what can the average punter go, the guy who believes in a two-parent family sitting there and shaking his fist at the camera or his computer or iPhone? But you've supplied some of the answer to that. But is there anything else the individual can do with his pension fund or whatever? I mean,
absolutely. Well, the first thing to do is make sure you're not invested in any of the big three funds. So that's BlackRock, State Street, and Vanguard. All three of those companies have taken net zero pledges. So if you have money, if you have a dime of money being invested with them, they're using the shares they bought with your money to push those companies to hit harmful inflation increasing net zero targets and other, you know, various, like you said, you know, attack the two-parent family, all kinds of nasty social nonsense. The second thing is, if you live in the United States or even if you live in Europe, to contact your elected representatives and let them know you don't want this push with your money. A lot of the asset manager business is investing state pension funds and sovereign wealth funds. So your politicians are ostensibly in charge of those, and they're accountable. Don't let them give you an excuse. They could pass laws that would ban BlackRock or even fire them, which is something we push for, is just firing them and finding something else, finding someone new. And if people would like to know more about what's going on in the woke space, they can go to consumersresearch.org. And we, in addition to putting out email newsletter, we also have what we call our woke alerts, where people can give us their cell phone number and we will text you, not a lot, just about once a week, about woke activism that's going on, you know, companies that are going woke. This week's will be about BlackRock and this action by the Mississippi Secretary of State. And so you can keep involved, and we always make sure, not just, we don't want to just get people angry, as you said, like, you know, just shaking their fist at the screen and just left feeling impotent. We always give a way to get activated, to either call the customer service lines of these companies. It does matter. I've heard from a number of executives through back channels that when we have swarmed their phone lines with complaints about them going woke, it absolutely rattles the C-suites and the boards of directors of these companies. And in fact, shortly after we attacked American Airlines, their CEO was fired about five months later. So it does, these types of things do matter, and consumers matter. Your actions matter. You should use your dollars, but also your voice.
Will, that's brilliant. Can we just, we've only got 2 minutes left, and we were going to talk more about nuclear as well, but I don't know if we can launch into a new topic, but maybe you could say, well, we're kind of pro nuclear power on this show, and you can perhaps give us your two cents on where that argument is going and what the best case is, because you've argued the other case very eloquently, but you've got 2 minutes to do so.
Absolutely. Well, I'm very pro-nuclear. I think fossil fuels are great, but if we can move to a higher energy density, that's been the name of the game when it comes to human flourishing and civilization. Every time we've moved to a new energy source, the transition has been from a lower density source to a higher density source. And there is no human technology right now higher density than nuclear. So I think investment in nuclear technology, some of the fourth generation stuff is incredible, the modular. If the ESG advocates, if the net zero advocates actually were serious, if they weren't just hypocrites, if it wasn't all just lies in order to satisfy their megalomaniac delusions, they would be embracing nuclear. It is the greatest net zero carbon emissions source. And yet instead, they want to invest in these boondoggles of wind and solar that require fossil fuels still to be produced. They require extremely expensive harmful mining operations in places like the Congo, where they use slave labor. We would be ignoring all of that and moving towards nuclear if these people were serious, which is why you don't have to take any of these environmentalists seriously when they, if they're going to ignore nuclear, they're not serious.
Yeah. Will Hill, love to have you on talking more about those things. Brilliant conversation we had. Thank you very much. Will Hill, talking about lots of interesting things about corporate malfeasance. We'll have you on again, William Hill. This is Pelle Neroff-Taylor's show on TNT News Talk.